Welcome to Heart Yoga Radio. Here we are, off on another walk down the canal. There's quite a lot of people around today, so it might be a few interruptions. It's also really strangely freezing for this time of year. So I was thinking that we could carry on with our short recordings that we do just about particular terms. So I thought, lots of dogs around.
Dog city.
So I thought we could start with enlightenment. What is enlightenment? So how's your brain feeling, Pete? Bright, sparky?
It feels like an old gentleman sitting on a back porch, dozing and dribbling on a Sunday afternoon with a nice tartan blanket over his legs.
Oh.
In a kind of mellow and vacant.
Well, he sounds like a nice chap.
Yeah.
I'm sure he has lots of thoughts, although perhaps
kind of
gently and slowly described.
They're a little bit random, a bit like pink fluffy clouds scudding across a blue sky. Well, not scudding, but drifting. Look.
Oh, yeah.
Baby ducks.
Oh, baby ducks and coots.
Moorhens.
Oh, they're so cute.
Oh, there's some kind of like fracas going on over there. Anyway, we mustn't bore our listeners with observations of Mother Nature. What was the question again?
Well, let's just crack on with what is enlightenment?
Enlightenment is a fantasy of the unenlightened.
Yes, do go on.
Well, basically, enlightenment is a word.
Yes.
And as a word, it signifies. That means and it also has connotations.
Yes, it does.
Yes. It actually refers to not one idea, or one concept, or one thing, or one state of being, but to many.
Yeah.
And it depends who's saying it, as to what they mean. Now, these different meanings do belong in a family together. They are related. They're not completely disconnected. But nevertheless, we're not really talking about one thing. It's a funny word, because it's a word that does pretend that it's got a kind of a clear denotation, that it denotes one thing that we can be very precise about. And it has that kind of ring to it. And the people that use the word try and produce that effect of authority when they use it. So yeah. It's a peculiar word.
You do see it bandied about in ways which make it clear that people don't really.
Well, they say things
about.
Like, oh, Shri Shri, what's his face? He's enlightened, therefore everything he says is completely right.
Yeah.
And we must do exactly what he says. And if he wants us to kind of drink his piss, we'll do
and
it.
We will, because he is enlightened.
Yeah. Now that might sound a bit.
Is it just me, or are the enlightened masters nearly always men?
Well, it's a boys' game.
Yeah.
But boys, given their kind of phallic equipment, like to aim for something kind of supreme and final.
Yeah.
A bit like an orgasm or an ejaculation, you know. For some people, enlightenment is this kind of final orgasm of the mind.
Not that we're being at all rude about these so-called enlightened masters or anything.
No. I suppose what I could do is talk about three or four of the different ways in which the word is used in true Wittgensteinian style as a means of exposing what it does.
Yeah, that sounds
and
like
how,
a good
how it
idea.
Functions.
We're just passing a football game.
Yeah, and we've already mentioned one function, which is to claim for the utterer some kind of authority, either on his or her own behalf, or the behalf of some purportedly enlightened Waller.
Yeah.
It's important to understand that and to see how it's used like that. In in yoga and in areas of Buddhism, we've got kind of fairly frequent use of the idea of enlightenment. But it's categorised differently in different quarters. For instance, you've got the notion that you see in the last part of the Yoga Sutra, where Patanjali talks about Kivalya.
Patanjali.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's a word that's construed as meaning some kind of final beatitude or enlightenment. You could translate it as enlightenment. It generally translates as meaning isolation. And this is a concept of enlightenment, in which the enlightened person is somehow completely isolated from the world. This is one reading only, and it's not my reading, I would add. But there is a notion that the highest good is to somehow be isolated into consciousness, that there is just consciousness. Not even the body is in the picture. Everything is withdrawn to a pure consciousness without relationship. Which strikes me as a bit of a morbid a morbid conception. I can see how people might aspire to that, given that life is hard.
Yeah.
Even in the most felicitous life, it is hard, and death is hard. Even though we manage very often to sort of comfort ourselves in the face of all these brute facts of existence and kind of keep trucking and laughing and joking and so on, but nevertheless at bottom there is a certain incentive to withdraw,
yeah,
and to become isolated and to overcome, to transcend this life. It gives us plenty of incentive. But I actually think what's happening there is there a fearful reaction to finding oneself alive somehow aggrandizes itself with some posh congratulatory terms, you know. So enlightened, he's enlightened, he's completely withdrawn. And that's Kivalya. I don't actually think that is what Patanjali was getting at, but some pretty influential people do interpret Kivalya in a way similar to what I've just outlined.
Yeah.
Also, a kind of a fairly crude reading of the Nirvana. Buddha was enlightened because he attained Nirvana.
Mm-hmm.
And Nirvana is very often again glossed as the blowing out of the flame. The flame being the flame of desire. Or the flame of Trishna, or thirst, or and presumably what's being talked about here is the desire for things to be better. So according to the Buddha, we find life unsatisfactory, frustrating. So dukkha is frustrating. Mm. Things don't flow. We have a bumpy ride. So we want out.
Yeah.
But the thing that causes the discomfort, the thing that actually intensifies the discomfort of unsatisfactoriness of life, is the itch to get out of it, for things to be different. So on that level, it's kind of a fairly intelligent analysis, I think, you know. But again, it gets a kind of little bit generalised in the kind of commentaries that we see these days, and the fact that we've seen for a couple of thousand years, and unsatisfactoriness, dukkha, just becomes desire per se.
Yeah.
So you then get this project of trying to be enlightened by never having an erection.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which again, it's kind of stupid, and it's life negating. As is the Kivalya, as misunderstood by some of Patanjali's commentators. Yeah. That is life negating also.
Yeah. And if enlightenment does exist, then we would be pretty sure that life negation would not be part of that,
I would be saying if somebody's enlightened that they would affirm life.
Yeah.
Really, really deeply and totally. Yeah. Affirm it as it is.
That's the sound of a barge you can hear that there.
Yeah.
Having a little bit of trouble with his engine, I think.
It's blowing smoke rings out of the chimney. Look. They have fantastic smoke rings coming out of the chimney.
Oh, yeah.
Revving the motor.
I hope it's okay.
It ain't very good. It shouldn't be doing that much smoke, should it?
Not really.
Anyway, that's a working barge as well, though.
Yeah.
It's not like day trippers. This guy's got a cargo on.
Yeah. So, no life negation, please. We're enlightened.
Well, I mean, what I'm offering there is yet another persuasive definition. All definitions of enlightenment, this is the thing about it, tend to be persuasive because they're kind of mixed up with a dominance game, a political game of dominance. You know, because if your enlightened sage is enlightened, he's then infallible and therefore should wield power. So there's, and these discourses are always embedded in political and material realities.
Yeah.
So, for that reason, and I don't want to go too far into that, but for that reason, whenever anybody utters the word enlightenment, they're being persuasive. That means they're trying to impose their agenda on the term.
Yeah.
in order to promote their agenda.
Yeah.
But as I said, it's the fantasy of the unenlightened, because the unenlightened really would like things to be different. The itch drives them. And so therefore they believe in it. They believe that even if not for them, but for somebody, there is a possibility of living with a kind of a beatitude or an indifference or in a way in which one is impervious to life's sufferings. These are all kind of compensatory fantasies. Which get blessed with this very high name, this enlightenment. Yeah? Another use, if I can kind of expand a bit, another use of the term connotes knowledge. In fact, the Western phenomenon of a cultural, political, and scientific and philosophical movement that took place in the 18th century in Europe and America, which was poised for revolution, and that during that period, which we call it the Enlightenment, or the European Enlightenment.
Yeah.
And it's got nothing to do with sitting under a bough tree. Mm. It's to do with the acquisition of knowledge.
Yeah.
And the new way of.
It's interesting they gave it that name.
Yeah. Well, I don't know who used it in English first, but Kant wrote a paper, you know, which was published in a newspaper in 17 whatever, in the 1780s. He was just entitled, you know, "What is Enlightenment?" You know, in German, "Was ist Aufklärung?" I think so.
Yeah.
And this is all to do with knowledge. It's to do with knowledge and ways of knowing. But of course, that's one of the notions that again is prevalent amongst yoga, Buddhist, Taoist thinkers. Yeah. We talk about Gan Yoga, you know, the yoga of knowledge, and talk about an enlightened being as one who knows. One who knows.
Yeah.
And you can see how that works out. The light dawns, the light goes on.
Yeah.
When you get something, you can say, "Oh God, thank you for enlightening me."
Yeah.
When you explain to me some finer point of Euclidean geometry that I hadn't got.
Yes.
And it enlightens me.
So I explain stuff like that to you all the time.
Well, you do, yeah. I don't know what I do without you. Just do not know what I do without you. So, of course, what's happening there is that there's knowledge. And Patanjali, and he talks about samadhi, which is an enlightenment experience. Again, not many commentators noticing this about Patanjali, but he's talking about knowledge very often, or wisdom, you know. Mm. He's talking about enlightenment being as a kind of a dawning of some insight into the way things are, as items of knowledge. And it's quite a nice notion, you know. And very often people claiming to be enlightened do seem to possess some kind of wisdom. Not always, because anybody can claim to be enlightened. But it doesn't mean they know everything. We could go and sit in one of Buddha's discussion circles 2,500 years ago or nearly, and say, well, excuse me, Lord Buddha, can you tell me about quarks? Yeah. Well, he wouldn't be able to.
No.
You know, the Buddha doesn't know everything. And similarly, the great sages don't know everything. Nobody knows everything. So we really, really knock on the head the pretense that there's people that kind of know everything.
Yeah.
And that that's somehow going to absolve us from making our own inquiries,
yeah,
struggling our own struggles, sitting on our own meditation cushion, finding our own samadhi, etc.
Yeah.
It doesn't absolve you. It's lazy. They don't know everything. But there are certain experiences which make you feel that you do know a lot. You know, you find you can feel that you know a lot more than you did know. And actually it pans out sometimes, not always. Sometimes it does pan out. And there does seem to be some insight available to human beings when they get out of their own way.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, but... And those kind of experiences and those kind of scenarios also kind of attract the label enlightenment. I think some of our modern Advaita teachers kind of push that, you know, they represent themselves as white ones who know.
Yeah.
They know that everything's one, that ego is an illusion, etc. But to my mind, a lot of that just degenerates into being able to tell the story, being able to find yourself your way around the terminology, being able to play the game of talking in a different way.
Yeah.
And very often I don't think there's much more to it than that.
You use the term enlightenment, not that, yeah, you do very often.
No.
But when you do, what do you mean by it?
I think when I say it, I'm always alert to all these wrinkles that I've just briefly sketched out.
Yeah.
I'm always aware that enlightenment is a fantasy of the unenlightened.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I do see and know for a fact that there are beatific states, being states, available for human beings. And they're actually the root state, the basic state, the root code,
yeah,
of the human being is beatific and wise and loving and compassionate. That is like the basis on which human life gets to happen at all. So that means it's available to us, but it's very close to us.
Yeah.
And when those states are operating in a life, the life's still going to be difficult. It's not going to save you from death. You know, you could still get malaria, etc.
Yeah. Yeah.
You can still put money on a horse and it doesn't win.
Yeah.
So, but nevertheless, they are a great they're kind of great enhancers of life. They are And the thing I'd say about that is that in the light of those experiences, affirmation is possible. Life affirmation is possible. And to me, that's the forgotten aspect of enlightenment that I just would want to bring to the fore.
Yeah.
If you don't affirm life, if there's some life negation in there, you're just talking.
Yeah.
You're just talking a posh talk. So, life affirmation. Life affirmation.
Yeah. And I, I have been for a long time, and still am extremely wary of any kind of advert or poster, or even if it's some sort of advert via word of mouth,
yeah,
where someone claiming to be enlightened is going to be delivering a talk or a workshop or something like that.
Yeah.
I would immediately put me off.
Yeah.
Anyone who's trumpeting themselves as enlightened and shouting about how enlightened they are probably not, I feel. Oh, passing buses. I mean, there might be, it's possible,
yeah.
You know, there might just be a very exuberant person who's just happy just to kind of throw it around like that.
Yeah, I think that could, I think that can happen, and I think it kind of, it does happen.
But all the same.
Why should you have an inhibition?
Yeah. Oh yeah, I'm not saying that they would naturally have an inhibition, but I think they would be naive of the consequences of what they are doing.
It's not really a skillful means, I think, to engage the term at all. Because it's just so prone to feeding into these compensatory fantasies.
Yeah.
Of wanting the better, something that itches a bit less than human life, to be a refuge for us from the suffering.
We just want to believe it's possible to be in a place where you don't have to suffer, don't we?
Yeah, and we're either then, if we're kind of very kind of self-possessed in some way, just as a matter of character, we would then like try and be enlightened ourselves. Or we'd pretend to be, or whatever, but we put ourselves in that position.
Yeah.
We would live out the fantasy and set things up so that the fantasy was being confirmed all the time.
Yeah. But another reason why I would be very suspicious of any advert is in trying to persuade me to come and sit at the feet of some enlightened master is because it always just immediately smacks of a rather kind of manipulative and quite disgusting marketing ploy.
Oh, yeah. Now, for somebody who thinks, well, enlightenment's real, thank God enlightenment's real, but it's not possible for me, I'm too lowly, I've got too many neuroses, I need a few more rebirths, or a few hundred more rebirths to get to it, and I'm full of humility and self-disgust and blah blah, but I am consoled by the fact that somebody can be enlightened, like Fred Bloggs is enlightened.
Yeah.
And he's an American, for fuck's sake, and he's enlightened, you know. So, therefore, it's possible.
No disrespect to our American friends there.
Therefore, it's possible.
Yeah.
Therefore, I feel better.
Yeah.
And then you get the whole kind of transference and daddy nonsense.
Yeah.
The Indian culture is exploited to the max. You know, foot kissing and drinking the bath water and the ridiculous, uncritical adoration.
Yes, we're not making this up. So, this really does happen.
Yeah, excuse me. And that whole kind of shambles.
Yeah.
Then ensues. And you're right. It's exploitative, basically.
Yeah.
On many levels, psychological, financial. And so on. So you've got to watch it, basically.
Yeah.
Dear readers, dear listeners, you've got to watch it with
yes,
these
whenever you,
stuff.
You see or hear the word enlightenment,
just think.
Just step back a little bit and think.
Yeah. Pete Yates says.
Yeah. Remember this.
Just be very careful of these wallets.
That's right. Be careful. Be
of these
careful.
Wallets. And he should know, because he's enlightened.